At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Is it just me, or does it seem like we've been talking about this debt limit thing forever? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday today. This one is the 26th of July. Glad you could be with us. There were more debt limit machinations in Washington on this Tuesday. The White House seemed to threaten a veto of the plan House Speaker John Boehner offered yesterday. In a statement a couple of hours later, though, the administration downgraded its language to strongly opposing the Boehner plan. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has the very latest on the day's events.
The president and Republican leaders spent 2 hours trying to reach an agreement to extend the government's authority to borrow for a few weeks while details of the budget are debated. In the end, Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole said the president would not agree to a balanced budget in 7 years in return for a debt ceiling increase.
The president made it very clear up front.
Yeah, okay, so no, that wasn't today. Dimsdale's been around for a while. That was a debt limit story from 16 years ago. Marketplace, November the 1st, 1995. Offered in the spirit of more things change, I guess. What hasn't been changing as this debate has drawn out, just this debate, not the one since 1995, is how Americans feel about it. Carol Daugherty is the Associate Director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. Mr. Daugherty, welcome to the broadcast.
Good to be here.
Well, let's get right to it. How do the American people feel about this whole debt thing?
Overwhelmingly, the public says, get a compromise done, even if it means on a package that I disagree with. I mean, that's what Americans are telling us. 68% are saying their lawmakers who agree with them should be willing to compromise even on a package that they don't necessarily agree with.
And yet what we hear from Washington is members of one party saying the American people will not stand for benefit cuts and members of the other party saying we will not have tax increases.
Well, the public is acknowledging that a little of both is needed. I mean, they're not specific about the deal. And of course, there's disagreements about various aspects of it, but we still get a consistent 60% saying that this deal would have to include, or any way to reduce the budget deficit would have to include some tax increases and some spending cuts. That's been a consistent finding from our polls since last December.
Can you break it down for me along party lines, Democrat versus Republican?
Certainly more support among Democrats, 81% support for a compromise versus 53% of Republicans. But that 53% within there, there's a huge divide in the Republican Party between those who support the Tea Party and those who don't. In fact, 53% of Tea Party supporters say stand on principle, even if it means a default.
Let me follow up on that number about the Tea Party, though. I mean, it does seem that they are having a disproportionate influence on this debate, right?
Well, I mean, they're an important segment of the Republican Party at this point. I mean, in fact, they're very engaged. They were very crucial to the 2010 outcome, and 53% of those Tea Party Republicans are saying no deal, and that's a very important number.
Where do you suppose politicians get their figures when they say the American people want this or the American people want that? I mean, are they just making it up?
Well, I suppose they take it from the polls, but I'm sure they do a selective reading of the polls that supports their own side. That's typically what we see, although most lawmakers and politicians insist that they don't read the polls. I'm sure they do.
Yeah. Are we still optimistic that we will have a deal at some point?
That may be one of the most surprising findings in our poll, that 56% still say that President Obama and Congress will resolve this by the August 2nd deadline. That's no different than a Washington Post ABC poll from last week. So the optimism hasn't declined, even though there's been this back and forth and missed signals and negotiating problems.
Yeah. So one of the things that's happening in Washington as this debate has dragged on is that other economic policy issues have been crowded out. We're not hearing a lot about jobs. We're not hearing a lot about education or immigration policy, any of those things. Is the debt ceiling the American people's biggest economic worry?
Not at all. It's still jobs. 39% to 29% still say the job situation is the economic issue that worries them most. That has not changed since May. You know, the budget deficit number has been rising over the past several months, but until May. But since May, there's been no change at all.
Carol Daugherty is the Associate Director at the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. Mr. Daugherty, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
On Wall Street Today, opinion was negative. We'll have the details when we do the number. Ford and Chrysler turned in respectable earnings numbers today. Respectable, that is, considering the woeful state of the American economy. Ford's now been profitable for 2 years running. Chrysler would have turned a small profit if not for the $500 million it spent paying back government loans. You throw GM in the mix, and American automakers are riding high after near collapse 2 years ago. But Marketplace's Jeff Horowitz reports this is no time to nod off behind the wheel.
The U.S. auto industry is parked in a paradox right now. Sean McElinden is chief economist at the Center for Automotive Research.
Sales aren't growing fast this summer at all because of the unstable and uncertain economy. On the other hand, the companies are profitable.
So how's that happen? Well, first you have acts of man. The car makers emerged from near death with lower labor costs and better products. Then you have an act of God, a tsunami that crippled the selection available from Honda and Toyota. Analyst Dave Sullivan of Auto Pacific says consumers who are car shopping are more often checking out American cars and paying full sticker price.
Inventories for both used and new vehicles are extremely tight right now, and that's really playing to the automaker's advantage in terms of reducing incentives and having to eat away at the bottom line.
The rest of the year looks uphill. The Japanese are ramping back up. Raw material costs are rising. Ford, Chrysler, and GM all start bargaining new union contracts this week. And then there's the economy. Still, Sean McElinden of the Center for Automotive Research says the U.S. automakers are able to operate lean for a while.
So the companies are in a position now to make good money at much lower volumes, which means if the higher volumes ever do return, they should be, you know, obviously more profitable. But we've been waiting and waiting and waiting for that pent-up demand to really show up, and it hasn't.
In the meantime, today's earnings suggest the Detroit Three are much better positioned than before to wait things out. I'm Jeff Horowitz for Marketplace.
Speaking of cars, well, speaking of drive-thrus, actually, if I can stretch the segue just a bit, McDonald's said today it's putting Happy Meals on a diet. Over the next couple of months, the little bag of fries is going to shrink by half. Less salt overall, more fruit. But as Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports, the new healthier Happy Meal may actually be about selling more junk food, not less.
We all know what kids really like about McDonald's.
There's a Barbie in your Happy Meal.
Thing is, McDonald's has been under pressure for the fatty, salty, high-calorie food that goes with all those Barbies and Transformers. Today, the company said beginning in September, it'll cut Happy Meal calories about 20% by shrinking the fries and including fruit or veggies. Sarah Senator is an analyst with Sanford Bernstein.
The idea is that there will also be some contingent of people who will say, well, maybe now I'll consider McDonald's for my kids because I like what they're doing here.
They may also consider it for themselves. Peter Soleil of Telsey Advisory Group says this is not just about selling to kids.
You're also bringing in the sales that, you know, their parents would otherwise spend somewhere else. So if you're selling more Happy Meals, you're likely selling more burgers, fries, and these McCafe drinks to their parents.
McDonald's says it'll offer different options like carrots, apples, maybe mandarin oranges. Sounds expensive, says Technomic restaurant analyst Darren Tristano.
This will add cost to the meal, and likely the price will go up.
And keep this in mind. McDonald's has been offering Happy Meals with apples and caramel dipping sauce instead of fries since 2004, and only about 10% of people go for that version.
I suspect a lot of the apples will be consumed by the parent who doesn't want to waste it.
and can no longer get their hands on their kids' tiny bag of fries. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
The United Nations said today 11 million people in the Horn of Africa are at risk of starvation. The UN called the area of Kenya, Somalia, and Ethiopia that have been affected by drought the Triangle of Death. Somalia's recent history of terrorism and piracy is scaring away a lot of potential donors, the British not among them. Britain is now one of the world's most generous sources of international assistance. It gives, as a percentage of GDP, more than double what the United States gives. But the Cameron government's commitment to being an aid superpower comes at a time of deep domestic budget cuts. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that story now from London.
British TV news has carried daily reports of drought, famine and death in the Horn of Africa.
Dadaab is a place where life hangs in the balance every single day.
And these heart-wrenching reports of starving children have reignited a debate in the British Parliament.
Questions to the Prime Minister.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Prime Minister David Cameron has capitalised on the grim images from Africa to justify one of his less popular policies.
I think it once again demonstrates that we are right to maintain and increase our spending in this difficult in this area, difficult as the arguments sometimes are.
In spite of making deep budget cuts at home to reduce the deficit, Cameron has stepped up spending on overseas aid. Over the next 3 years, the UK will splash out an extra $5 billion, not just on emergency famine relief, but on development, building roads, hospitals and schools in Africa and elsewhere in order to alleviate poverty.
That aid is really about saving lives.
Helen Mogombo of the British aid agency Oxfam welcomes the Cameron largesse.
Charity should not end at home. I think we should understand that the British government and other rich governments have got a responsibility to support the poorest in the world.
But while no one would begrudge emergency humanitarian assistance, many do challenge the plan to pump ever-increasing amounts of taxpayers' cash into overseas development.
I think it's a quite extraordinary decision by the British government.
Mark Littlewood, head of the Free Market Institute for Economic Affairs.
It may help Britain preen itself on the international stage and give Prime Minister Cameron a warm glow about the good deeds he believes he's doing, but the actual impact on the ground is lamentable.
Aid does not promote growth, he says. Just look at the figures. Over the past three decades, Africa received 16 times more aid per head than China, and yet the African economy shrank while China took off. And then there's the question, who deserves a helping hand? India has its own space program. It has nuclear weapons and it gives billions of dollars in aid to Africa. And yet India will itself receive more than $1.5 billion in aid from Britain over the next 4 years. But as Prime Minister Manmohan Singh told the BBC, he's not complaining.
If some friendly country offers, I think, a large amount of money, I don't see reasons why we should decline to accept.
The British government points out that India still has 450 million people living in abject poverty and that British aid helps alleviate their plight. Mark Littlewood is not persuaded.
The United Kingdom could start to say that it was, I don't know, worried about certain US welfare programs and was now going to spend money in Alabama or Texas on Americans who we didn't believe were being satisfactorily looked after by their government.
The British government says its aid plan is not only morally right, it will create opportunities for British business. It will win friends abroad. But it seems to be losing them at home. According to the latest opinion poll, 57% of Brits in this time of austerity want aid spending cut. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, why you ought to think twice about leaving the house on payday.
The lowest number of deaths is a day before the first, and then there's a large spike in mortality on the first of the month.
Freakonomics strikes again, but first, let's do the numbers. Another day of low trading volume as investors wait to see what happens with the debt ceiling debate. The Dow Industrials lost 91 points, about 0.7% for the blue chips, finished at 12,501. The Nasdaq erased 2 points, a 0.1%, 2839 at the bell. The S&P 500 down 5 points, 0.4%, 1331. 3M led today's decline, scraping off nearly 5.5%. The conglomerate had sales growth in most of its divisions, but faces higher operating expenses. AK Steel Holdings was knocked down 17.5% today after missing analyst estimates. U.S. Steel fell more than 8%. Netflix down 5% today. I guess people really don't like those price increases. Ford Motor Company decelerated 1.75% even after that earnings report we told you about. And we told you about it on Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases durable goods orders for June. The CEOs of Walmart, Kimberly-Clark, and other companies testify before the Senate Finance Committee on how the tax code affects hiring. And Olympic gold medalist Peggy Fleming turned 63. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Well, day two of the debt ceiling-inspired market apocalypse watch ended with more of a whimper than a bang today. Stocks we just told you about. Yields on the 10-year T-note, which I didn't get to, actually fell just a tad. Not exactly a sign of investor skittishness, but not all market signals come from prices. You know, out in Chicago, the CME Group, that's the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, is making life more difficult for traders who want to back their bets in the market with treasuries. Marketplace's Adrienne Hill has the why and the why it matters.
To really understand why this matters, let me explain a bit about futures markets. Basically, they allow companies to hedge against price fluctuations and let investors bet on the price of commodities or other valuables in, well, the future. It goes something like this. A trader wants to buy some futures contracts. To do that, the exchange requires that he insure the purchase.
When posting collateral, when posting funds, most accounts post T-bills.
T-bills are, of course, treasury bills. And the man helping me explain is analyst John Brady from MF Global. He says what the CME Group has done, at its simplest, is reduce the purchasing power of treasury bills by raising what's called the haircut. No, it has nothing to do with the barbershop. The haircut is the percentage the clearinghouse shaves off the top of the value of a treasury bill. So now $1 million in T-bills will buy fewer futures contracts than it did before.
It's another way for the firm to perhaps just kind of cushion itself in case kind of things get a little bit out of hand in the coming days, coming weeks.
Analyst Philip Verleger says the raised haircut is a big deal.
And what it does is state that the CME Group views U.S. debt as less valuable.
Less valuable than before the debt ceiling mess. Verleger says it could impact all of us.
Marginally, very marginally. It means that the costs of everything will go up.
How? He says if it costs a company like Kellogg's more to trade in the futures market, those costs could get tacked on to our box of cornflakes. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
About a year ago, 1 million gallons of crude oil spilled from a broken pipeline into the Kalamazoo River in Michigan. It was an especially sticky kind of crude. It's from the tar sands up in Canada. And this cleanup is still going on today, which, as it happens, is when the House is set to vote on a bill to fast-track another major pipeline from the same source. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Tro reports.
The Keystone XL pipeline project is indeed extra large. It would carry 1.2 million barrels of crude a day from Canada to the Gulf Coast. The company TransCanada has waited 3 years to build it, double the normal permit time, says Marty Durbin at the American Petroleum Institute.
Everyone that had a concern about the pipeline had ample opportunity to weigh in with their concerns. So frankly, the expectation was that a decision would have been made last year.
He says even if the House bill gets stopped in the Senate, it tells the White House this project's too big to wait. But the huge size and scope of the pipeline is exactly why critics say, let's wait longer. Susan Casey Lefkowitz at the Natural Resources Defense Council says this is a new type of oil with a new set of risks.
It's a fairly new product. We're not used to taking this raw tar sands oil in our pipes. It's more corrosive. It has more acids in it. It has more little sand particles.
The White House plans to have a full report on the Keystone XL pipeline by August and give a thumbs up or down by the end of the year. The House bill demands a decision by November 1st. Michael Levy at the Council on Foreign Relations says that two-month gap isn't a big deal for the oil companies, and diligence is vital.
If they rush the environmental assessment and don't clear it with all the right people, they will expose the process to public challenge. And if that happens, the pipeline will also get into trouble.
He says the White House wants more input on the pipeline, but doesn't want debate to spill out too far beyond its control. I'm Eve Troeh for Marketplace.
Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment in your lives every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen J. Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is, of course, the hidden side of everything. Dubner, where you been, man? Missed you.
Here, everywhere.
all over the place.
Good to be back with you, though.
And always good to have you. What are we talking about today?
I got a question for you, Kai, a little riddle. What do Fayetteville, North Carolina, and Fairbanks, Alaska have in common, do you think?
They both start with the letter F. That's all I got.
That is a Rizdalian logic that I admire very much. But even more than F, they both got military bases.
Oh, yes,
okay.
They do.
Fort Bragg is in Fayetteville and yep. Fort Wainwright in Fairbanks. Mm-hmm. And therefore, because of that, depending on the day of the month, these two towns are going to have a strikingly similar problem. Here's Craig Kubala, who's a Marine in Fayetteville.
Traffic. Is obviously expeditionally increased.
And here's the police chief in Fairbanks, Laren Zager, who's got his own strategy for dealing with this problem on that special day.
I follow the path of least resistance in my personal life to the degree that I can. So you become aware of these things and where the traffic is and isn't.
Again, I'm obliged to tell you I don't like quizzes on my own radio program, Dubner. But
no, you don't. That's why we bring them.
What day are we talking about here?
Plain and simple, we're talking about payday. So when you're in a military town, a lot of the population is getting paid on the same day. And yep. Kai, what do people do when they get paid?
I know what they do. In this economy, they save it, Dubner. They go straight to
no. Would that it were so.
Yeah. They spend. We all do.
They do. We go out. We do stuff. We buy stuff. We entertain ourselves. Here's Greg Adams, who's a clerk at a gun store in Fayetteville called Shooter's Supply.
So we'll be busy Friday, Saturday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and it'll trickle off. And by next pay period, we'll be standing around here quiet, waiting on the next payday.
Right. Now, up in Alaska, it's not just the military payday. You've also got once a year the permanent fund, the oil dividend that all the Alaska residents get. It usually comes out in October. Here's Adam Wool, who owns a nightclub in Fairbanks called the Blue Loon. He says business is great around the time of this permanent fund dividend.
I've had certain performers have requested coming up around that time, the Chippendales Dancers, Mail Review, their management is, he always wants to come up around permanent fund time.
I guess because you know where the money is, no matter what the line of work is. Well, allow me to recap then. So people get paid, they go out and do stuff, they buy guns, they go see exotic dancers. And what? So where are you taking me, Dubner?
So no surprise there, a lot of activity, right? But there's a hidden side to this story. Let's hear from Bill Evans, who's an economics professor at Notre Dame. He noticed that something else happens when people get paid.
The lowest number of deaths is a day before the first, and then there's a large spike in mortality on the first of the month. And that pattern is very persistent over time across groups.
Right. So Evans and a colleague looked at all the deaths in the U.S. from 1973 to 2006. It's about 75 million deaths. And they looked at where they occur over the course of the month. And it turns out that mortality spikes on the first day of the month, stays high the next few days, and then steadily declines over the course of the month.
What I hear you saying, Dubner, is that people get paid and then they die.
That's exactly right. People get paid and die. Now, deaths around military bases spike about 10% around payday, but it's not just young people, military personnel, you know, going out and getting loaded, whatnot. Yeah. It's the permanent fund dividend up in Alaska, senior citizens who get their Social Security checks, tax rebates. Anytime there's a pay spike, you see that there's also a mortality spike.
Well, all right, so I'm confused because the mind immediately goes to the place where people get paid, they go out, do stupid things, and then they die. But clearly,
right.
that's not what's going on.
Well, that is a part of the story, right? Especially with younger people. But with the older people, it's not that. It turns out that some of it is risky behavior, right? Drinking, drugs, fights. But the real answer, it turns out to be, is simply activity. You go out and you drive, you go to the mall and so on. And, you know, you could all be safer sitting on our couches at home, but that's not what we do. And when we get money, we want to spend it. The ironic part to me is that Notre Dame, where Evans teaches, pays its employees just once a month. So that's a big spike all around town. And he personally has a strategy for keeping his three young sons safe around payday.
They're all swimmers, and the easiest way to keep their activity down is to keep them tired. So that helps discipline them. So keep teenage boys tired.
Hmm. So, Kai, I think this suggests with obvious legislation that we should push for in Washington is mandatory swimming for every citizen around the first of the month. What do you think of that?
Yeah, because they're doing so well down there. I love what they're doing. Stephen Dubner, freeeconomicsradio.com is the website. Dubner, we'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Can't wait. Thanks, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a very brief word on the way out about credit default swaps. You'll remember them from the financial crisis, of course, basically buying insurance against the possibility of somebody defaulting. Anyway, as just one example of how low U.S. debt is regarded right now by the market, it costs about the same today to insure Treasury bills as it does to insure Russian government bonds. It's actually cheaper to insure debt issued by Coca-Cola than it is to insure the full faith and credit of the United States of America. And so on that somewhat depressing note, that's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 91 points, about 0.7%. The Nasdaq shaved off 2 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 down 5 points. That is 0.4%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time, back here, steam power. Old-fashioned, you say? Au contraire.
It's the easiest way to reduce greenhouse gases and also maybe the cheapest way of getting more power for less dollars.
Who knew? I'm Kai Rizdal. I do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.